You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Nicholas Gazuk. Am I okay calling you Nick for the rest of the day? I'm not calling you Nicholas for the whole
100%.
Okay. We're going to talk to Nick about Enniskillen, ice wine, Canadian wine, and more. We're going to taste a bunch of ice wines. We have a whole bunch of bottles in front of us during this show and for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Ontario's own Nicholas Gazuk grew up around a wine-loving family with an interest in fermentation and chemistry. Nick graduated from the Niagara College Wine and Viticulture program. He went on to intern at wineries in Canada and also worked harvest in the Barossa Valley in Australia and Marlborough, New Zealand. He returned to Canada to work at Enniskillen in 2013, working under winemaker Bruce Nicholson and eventually becoming head winemaker in 2021. Nick stresses, and I'm going to quote him, "We must respect the fruit and terroir, as that is the foundation of every great wine. Our job as winemakers is to guide those grapes with as little intervention as possible into the bottle." Nick and Enniskillen are most recognized for their world-class ice wines. We're going to get into a bunch of other things. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Nick.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Did I get all that right?
You got all that right.
Okay.
Yep.
You know what I forgot to ask, and this is the dumbest question to ask on air. Pronounce Enniskillen for me.
Enniskillen.
It is Enniskillen, because
yes,
that I is in there. Because
yep,
I think a lot of people say Enniskillen.
Yeah, they kind of skip the middle,
yeah,
or miss the N or miss the double L.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's Enniskillen. All right, so we're talking to Nick in Midtown Manhattan. Nick made a market trip down here. We're at the offices of Colangelo & Partners. All right, let's get right into it, Nick. Your parents and grandparents were wine lovers, so you certainly grew around it. And your grandfather also made wine, home winemaker. What I'm curious about, because I can relate to the Northeast, New York, and all that, what was everyone drinking in those days? I mean, if they were wine lovers, were you drinking what I was drinking, or is it different in Canada?
It was a little bit different, right? So you think about the hybrid varieties that were around at that time, right? So Cayuga White, the Niagaras, all those Spumante character sweet wines were very prevalent in the area.
But that's what you were drinking?
Well, that's what
a lot
of people were drinking.
Were not a lot of wines available, but the locals were, and that's...
So the locals were there and cheap. Thankfully, we have what's called the LCBO, which is run by the government. So
Okay. They
bring a lot of imported wines. So we had access to all those French varieties, German varieties, Italian varieties, right? So we're slowly getting access to more and more, but yeah, it's a region that's developed over time and really starting to find its identity.
Right. What your grandfather made homemade wine, I mean, what kind of grapes was he using and where did he get them?
So he got them from local, there was a couple local nurseries in the Niagara region, and they were always a mixed hodgepodge of grapes, and he did what a lot of the home winemakers do, plant one vine of this, one vine of that.
So it was like a backyard field blend.
Backyard field blend, and then he'd blend everything together, press it off with one of the basket presses, and then throw it downstairs in a couple barrels, and then he'd slowly slice it off into demijohns, and it'd be Grandpa's special blend of the week.
So a lot of people I know, friends' parents, make home wine. And I would say 80% of the time, it's terrible.
Mm.
What's your memory of your grandfather's wine?
Oh, just the most bitter and sweet thing at the same time that you couldn't get your head around why it was so bitter, yet it was so sweet on the finish. I just never knew what
he did. Well, now that you're a winemaker, I mean, was it because he left the stems on or something?
I honestly think it's because he was impatient and never waited till they were fully ripe. I always remember him. He was smashing grapes and pressing grapes, and it seemed like it was always when I was going back to school. So that's September. We harvest grapes all the way into October and November in Niagara.
So he was very early.
So
the bitter is the picking.
The picking. So he was never patient enough to actually make a good wine, I think.
It's funny that it sounds like it was interesting. Was it okay? I mean, was it good?
It was not bad. Okay. You know, like he had a 9% alcohol wine with like, I don't know, 25 RS. And you know what? It had some flavor to it and some character to it. But he wouldn't sell it in a wine shop for $50, I'm telling you that.
No, I don't think he could get that, and they probably wouldn't take it. Tell me, you know, after growing up around that, we talked about you going to college. When did your real interest in wine
come
as a profession? Like looking forward, hey, I could do this or I want to do it. I mean, where were you? How old were you?
Yeah, so wines, again, it's a question I ask a lot of people is always, how do you get into wine, right? It's always, to be in wine, you have to be passionate. It was definitely not my first career path. I was a soccer player younger. I was really destined to go play a full-ride scholarship in the U.S.
Was that realistic?
It was realistic. It was on the table.
It wasn't your parents thinking you're good and you really
were. No, I had a scholarship. I had everything. Then I blew my knee out, lost my scholarship. So I started at Guelph University a little bit later. I did a bachelor's science and molecular biology and food science. I challenged myself. I'm always that guy. Being a competitive soccer player challenges the name of the game. I always have to have a challenge in front of me. So I took all the hardest classes, neuroscience and including food science, which was really the beginning of my fermentation journey and understanding what grapes were, where they had us make a cheese.
So that kind of was the jumping off point
where I really kind of thought, well,
being in school, being in classes, learning about fermentation.
That was very interesting to me. And then I was going to start a master's under a prof doing some research for cancer, and I realized it wasn't for me. So plan three was to move back to
Niagara. A little intense, right?
A little intense, yeah. That was a hard conversation with mom and dad.
Yeah.
And then I moved back to the Niagara region, and I was like, well, you know what? I'm from here. Wineries are growing. This is a big business around here.
What year are we talking?
So that would have been 2009-ish.
Okay.
There. And then I moved back. I volunteered for a winery for the summer. And then I hopped into the Niagara College program because I was kind of done with the university at that point. After the first couple months of being in the college program, still working at a winery, I was hooked. Just the amount of creativity, science, being outdoors, working with your hands. It was the perfect mesh of art, science, and creativity all together for me.
Right. So was I right that you went abroad?
So
was that your curiosity was so piqued, you know, how are other guys doing it? And
we're a cool climate region in Niagara, and I really wanted to, again, the reason to go to New Zealand was to find
get out of
that box and figure out what everybody else was doing. And then I wanted to experience the hot, right? So I went to the south of Australia, and I was there for quite a long time. Went to a producer that was pretty well renowned, Grant Burge. And you know what? It was a real good experience for me working in that heat, right? So taking aspects of all those different winemakers and then working under a couple other wineries at the same time. So I was doing dual vintages. So work a Southern Hemisphere harvest, come work at a North American winery, do a Southern Hemisphere. So it gets you some harvests under your belt really quick in a short period of time.
So you come back, and are you doing stuff before you get to Enniskillen, or?
Yeah, so at that time I was doing dual vintages, and I worked at a couple small wineries in the Niagara area. I worked at Rosewood Estates, Flat Rock.
Right, I forgot about that.
My second trip back to Australia, I was there actually driving a tractor at the same winery. And I did my interview with Bruce for Enniskillen from the tractor picking grapes at 3 o'clock at night because Australia that summer It was so hot and the time difference, right?
So that obviously went well, right?
It went well, and you know, the opportunity.
Did you know of Bruce at that point?
Yeah, right. So
I mean,
after school and studying and learning about Canadian winemakers, Bruce, again, the original winemaker for Jackson Triggs, was probably the most popular Canadian wine. And then he went to Enniskillen for the last 14 years. So, like, the opportunity to work under a guy that was successful not only in BC, but Ontario, huge opportunity.
All right, so that's a good segue for me. I want you to answer this question, but I don't want you to spend a ton of time on it, all right? And the question is, give me a brief history of Enniskillen.
Okay.
You know, you and I talked about it off air. It's been around a while, but not like, you know, Chateau Lafite Roth. You know.
No.
So give me a little, and anywhere you could weave in Canadian wine history or, you know, whatever, yeah, what was
fair
going
enough.
On. Just tell me, so when we start talking about the wine, you know, they know what the setup is.
Yeah, so the name is actually, it actually comes from the War of 1812. Colonel Brock and Colonel Cooper, they enlisted the help of other European nations to fight off the Americans. So a regiment came over, they were called the Enniskillen Fusiliers. And at the time after they won the war, it wasn't a, here's a bag of money, it was here's a piece of land. So the piece of land that Enniskillen now sits on was the land that was awarded to Cooper, which he named after the regiment that helped him win the battle. That piece of land was about 3 kilometers down from where Donald Zeraldo had his family nursery. So they used to grow grapevines and rootstocks. Carl was an immigrant that was in Austria, met his wife there. They moved back to Canada. At the time, he was, again, like yourself, like, what kind of wine is everybody drinking? And realized it was kind of crap. So coming from Austria and having good wines, he wanted to source vinifera vines. So he found that Zeraldo nurseries was selling them. Bought some, planted them, and was making wine at his house. And Carl, being the good gentleman that he is, brought Zeraldo some of those balls of wines. And Zeraldo said, you made this out of the grapevine? He goes, yeah. And then,
so Carl was doing it for years before Donald
came in? A couple years.
Right, Donald was supplying the...
He was supplying the grapevines. And then Donald, the salesman, and the two of them just hatched a plan to say, let's do this. So they went to the governor at the time, got the first winery license since Prohibition. They got that license, started planting the property that it currently is now, and it all evolved from there.
So we're talking mid-80s?
Beginning of the 80s. 70s, they were planting, 79, 78. The Vidal Vineyard that's actually on the Braeburns estate there, there's still 4 rows of 79 plantings. There's still 4 of the original Vidal rows there that we keep for show.
All right, so let's talk about that. So Enniskillen has multiple vineyard properties, right?
Yep.
I mean, acquisitions through the years type thing
definitely,
and all that.
Yep.
If people close their eyes and they think about Canada, where is Enniskillen located in Canada? And then tell me a little about just you're standing there. What am I feeling in the climate? What kind of soils am I dealing with? And let's talk about the vineyard properties. You just mentioned, what is it, Braeburn?
Yep.
You know, where there's the original rose and all that. It's certainly grown from that.
So I think people, when they think of Canada, they're thinking ice hockey and igloos, which is, you know, a huge misconception.
Molson.
A lot, like about 40% of the U.S. is above the Niagara region, right? So you look at it on a latitude scale of where Niagara is, runs through the tip of Northern California and through some of the greatest regions in Burgundy, right? So that climate, we have about 1,400 growing degree days, which is great. Mm-hmm. If you're standing on the Braeburn property, you're standing basically in a really cool microclimate region. And what's so cool about that is we have the lake to the north of us, Lake Ontario. It's one of the deepest freshwater lakes in the world.
So there's a lake effect for sure?
Big time lake effect. We have Niagara Falls running parallel to the region, which causes a huge influx of airflow because it's always running
so
water.
Just for me, how far is Niagara Falls away?
Niagara Falls is less than 15 kilometers.
Oh, okay.
So if you're standing at the Braeburn Estate, you could see the plume of moisture coming up from the falls.
Right
and then
there.
Behind us, we have the beautiful escarpment, which is this big elevation that allows what we call a diurnal effect, right? So the warm air from the lake rises, hits the escarpment, and then flows down. So anytime, even on the most still day, if you're anywhere else in Ontario, you could say that it was still. But in Niagara, you stand in one of our vineyards, you're always feeling airflow on your face because it's all sloped towards the lake, and that effect from the escarpment really forces the air down, which is really cool.
Yeah. You're kind of lucky to have that effect.
Very, very.
Without
very
it,
so.
I mean, you got problems.
Without it.
Soils
vary. They vary.
You know, because you can go to certain places, whether it's California or Burgundy, and you walk, you know, a half a you walk 10 yards and it's different.
Yeah, so there's, again, it's all carved out by an old glacier, Lake Iroquois Glacier, right? So there's a lot of clay. It's a lake bed soil scenario, right? So there's lots of clay, sand, silt, those sorts of characteristics. But then up on the bench, you have lots of stone, gravel, and limestone. And we have properties both on the plains in Niagara on the Lake and up on the bench, which is very cool. So even some of our table wines, we're blending bench fruit with warm, hot fruit, which gives two totally different characteristics.
You have the diversity and the choice.
Yeah, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about vineyard properties. You know, how many, where are they? You know, how far apart? Are you generally working in the region? You know, tell me.
Yeah, so our estate property, Braeburn, it's right tucked in the corner of what we call Four Mile Creek Appellation, which is right along the river. It's a little bit smaller.
Is that a designated appellation, or
So we have 12 designated appellations under VQA.
Okay.
Which is
What VQA is.
Yeah. So Vintners Quality Alliance is our governing body, right, just like the DOCG is, and all those other appellations. It was modeled after the French system, right? So we had somewhere to give a sense of place or terroir to our wines, right? So now that we can not only say that they're from Ontario or from Niagara, but we could dig down to a little bit to subdivide those areas.
Okay.
So we have properties pretty much in almost every appellation now as a company, because we're in a scale and zone by our Terra Wines Canada, which is the largest wine company in Canada. We operate a little bit independently of that brand, right? So everything.
When did that happen?
So we were owned by Constellation up until the beginning of 2019.
Right.
And we were bought by the Teachers Pension Fund, which started our Terra Wines
Canada. Was there an outside owner before Constellation?
So we were Vincor Canada before that, and
okay,
then Constellation bought us.
When did they sell to Vincor?
Vincor.
I mean, how long were they independent?
It was
90s?
No, it was up into the early 2000s.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
And then we were with Constellation for about seven years, and then we've been our Terra Wines for the last four now. So
you said you have properties in all the appellations. All owned or owned and contracted?
Owned and contracted. So as an internal, we own probably about 25 different sorts of properties varying in size. But again, contracted, some of these properties were actually owned by Inniskillner in the early days. If you look, we're on the Braeburn Estate. The property to the north of us is now owned by Vandelaar Vineyards, but was an Inniskillner property back in the day. Same with across the street. It's owned by Albert Seeger, but Carl and Donald actually planted that vineyard, right? So not that we don't own them, but they've been bringing their grapes to Inniskillner for over 35 years, and they still do today.
So all in, what kind of property are you dealing with?
So we as a company bring in close to 26 to about 29,000 tons, which is a good substantial, about 1,600 acres, which is a good chunk of change. It's quite a bit. So as a brand, Inniskillen makes about 260,000 cases of table wine and about 10 to 15,000 cases of ice wine a year.
It's a decent amount.
Yeah, it's a pretty big chunk of change.
Yeah. And for Canada.
And for Canada.
Yeah.
And then you asked about properties, and I really wanted to talk about Montague, which is a really iconic vineyard in Niagara. There's a few vineyards that have names that really ring bells with people. Lowry Vineyard, Montague. There's a couple of these well-known properties. And Montague has some really age-worthy vines on it now, some 40-year-old Chardonnay, 40-year-old Pinot Noir vines, which I get to play with, which is a lot of fun for our table wine program.
Wait, the vine age is only 4 years right now?
45.
Oh, 45.
45.
I'm saying, who cares about 4-year-old
wine?
Yeah,
4-year-old. No, that doesn't matter. No, 45, 42-year-old, right? So they're really coming into their own character and really showcasing what we can do in Niagara. And when I say that, it's about those specific varieties for me, Pinot, Chard, Riesling, and Cab Franc.
Interesting. You and I talked about this off air, and we both agree it's a tricky subject, and you and I could probably do a whole show on it. But, you know, I'll simplify the questions. Climate change. You know, everybody thinks, oh, Canada, cold weather. I'm more curious about what the effects of climate change has in a cold weather growing region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question was, how is climate change going to affect you? How does it affect that region and what you do, which is primarily ice wine?
Yeah. So I think the question, people think, well, is it going to be cold enough to make ice wine? And you know what?
It's getting warmer. Are you going to be okay?
We're going to be okay. I don't foresee that changing the next little bit. There's going to have to be a lot of ice that's going to have to melt before that happens. Again, if you've been in Canada in January and February, it's cold enough. I think the bigger question is, how's it affecting the growing season, right? The key to making great ice wine is having a good growing season and having healthy grapes, because you have to get them all the way through harvest and into that period where they actually freeze. So we're going to have a little bit of warmer temperatures. We're already set up as a region to have a kind of a shorter growing season than some of the great regions in the world, where they get bud break about 2 to 3 to 4 weeks earlier than we do. So I may potentially have to worry about the bud break being a little bit earlier and having a frost, like in France.
Which
have been challenging. This year,
you've seen all the burning pots and fans and everything.
This year, I see that they're largely unscathed. But again, that's a concern that we have. But we also are blessed with that lake, right? So it's a huge moderating effect to us. Do I see fluctuations in large amounts of heat? It's going to be challenging because the lake absorbs so much.
Does the lake freeze in the winter?
That's the key factor, too, on why we have so many grapes in the area, right? So if that lake ever froze over, what it does for us during the growing season is cool the vines at night. But in the winter, it absorbs all that heat during the summer and releases that heat, right? So it doesn't freeze over. So it can be in the north end of Toronto, minus 35 across the lake. But those northern winds are blowing that warm 2-3 degree air into the area, which keeps the vines kind of warm.
Interesting. So it's really on the front end where people, like you said, would think. And like I said, it's a very involved subject. All right, so let's start talking about the wines and what you're doing. So, you know, Canada is starting to make some good wines with, you know, a lot of different varietals, and we'll talk about them. We'll get into that in a few minutes. But let's stay in the wheelhouse for a little bit, all right?
Okay.
I want to talk to you about ice wine, which, among other places, is very much associated with Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think ice wine, you don't think South Carolina. All right, so you're the guy to help me with this. Tell my listeners, and, you know, don't be nerdy, try to be simplistic. Tell my listeners how ice wine is made.
Okay. So, again, there's the real way to make ice wine. The only way.
Is this the same question? What is ice wine and how is it made? Or, you know, if both of those need to... Okay,
I
so address
that. It's one
okay.
and the same.
Okay.
So the process of making ice wine is that we actually leave these grapes on the vine into the winter months where they actually freeze through solid. That temperature is regulated in order to call a product by VQA ice wine. It needs to
when
be...
When you say regulated, what do you mean?
So VQA, our controlling body, has a set regulation on what an ice wine is. That means it needs to be -8 when you pick it. It needs to be 35 degree Brix in a tank, so there's a minimum sugar
That's
requirement.
That's the sugar.
The grapes all need to be registered by November 15th. Any block you intend to pick for ice wine needs to be registered. Once you pick, you have to send a juice sample to them to get regulated and validated that it can be ice wine. And once we are done making the product, it has to go through a tasting panel that is controlled by VQA to make sure that it's a fit product to be called ice wine.
So before you start blending and everything, you're sending it to like a government panel where they go...
100%.
So that's kind of a pain in the ass.
A little bit, but...
So really the aspects are you have to get to a certain temperature, freeze,
yep.
You have to get to a certain sugar Brix level.
Correct.
And then what was the last thing?
And then you have to make the product and you have to get it tasted.
Right, you have to vint it and all of that. What's the temperature you said was what?
-8 Celsius.
So...
But...
Can it go above? It can't go below? I mean, so how does that... Nitpicking here.
So that temperature range will give you a very... Because, again, the idea is that we're actually freezing the grapes, right? We're separating the water. So we're forming crystals in the grape, leaving the water behind. And when we press, we're getting concentrated grape juice out of that, right? So instead of we're leaving 80 to 90% of the water behind, and we're getting concentrated juice liquid, right? In concentrating, we're getting all those beautiful flavors concentrated as well. What I like to say is there's a sweet spot when it comes to ice wine. And ice wine's made by a lot of Canadians, and -8's the regulation. I take it a step further at Enniskillen, and I go to -10. What that does for me is it shortens the window at which those sugars can come off. Because Enniskillen Ice Wine is all about balance. So I want to be between 38 degrees Brix and 42, which gives me a tighter constraint on the production of ice wine.
Right. So you push it a couple
of... I push it a little bit more, yeah. Right?
Was Nicholson and the other guys always doing that, or these are things you stumbled on?
Well, so again, the great thing about Enniskillen, right, is Carl largely started the whole process and tended to it for the first 15 years. Bruce, 15 years after him.
They experimented.
And they experimented, right? So, right. And that's a common question. What makes Enniskillen different, right? There's been three guys that have been doing this for 45 years. There's a lot of pitfalls when it comes to making ice wine and having the knowledge. I have Carl's old notebooks working under Bruce for 10 years. I've seen a lot of these pitfalls and I can avoid them very quickly. And it's also a good reference because every vintage year is a little bit different.
Well, with wine.
You know, with wine, that's standard.
I mean, I don't want to offend you, but it sounds like you have an easy job. All the work's been done before. Oh. I mean, I could probably go up there and do it, but that's another podcast. You'll interview me on that, all right? We won't worry about that. All right, so one last thing to that. You told us about the vineyard. Now, the wines are picked. The grapes are picked in a normal way, brought in, and it's basically made like wine we know wine made.
It's a little bit different, right?
Tell me the difference.
So, we used to always hand pick. It's a little bit challenging to get people to go out in the frigid cold and pick ice wine these days.
Hand pick because you'll damage? Or?
No. So, again, that's a big misconception. These grapes are frozen. They're like marbles. You can throw them off the ground, okay, and you're not going to do damage to them. It's a lot different than when you're picking table wine. It's also a good quality check when the harvester's going through because I can hear them frozen. Because real feel is a lot different than wind temperature, right? They actually have to be frozen through. Once we get them all picked to the winery, we need to press at minus 10 too, right? So that window of opportunity can only be 3 hours. So we need to pick and press at the same time.
Is this outdoor presses or temperature controlled?
Outdoor presses. Okay. Some of our growers
have. So you're on a tight window.
We're on a tight window.
You're picking and pressing pretty much within whatever.
Instantaneously, within half an hour.
Right. Okay.
They're picking, dumping bins, and I'm already starting to press.
So you press at the temperature, the juice starts flowing. So you got that out of the way, right?
Yep.
That's a requirement.
Yep.
Then what happens? You go through the process or it's different too?
So again, the juice, it's about making sure the juice is really healthy, right? So when it comes to Vidal, which is the common grape that we use, it's a very phenolic-y grape. So we do a little bit of
treatment. Explain what phenolic-y is.
Phenolic is, it's the ability of compounds in the juice to make it brown. Right, so
okay.
You don't want ice wine that looks brown or has
a brown
tinge.
If you leave an apple out and it turns brown, is that phenolics?
That's phenolics.
Okay.
That's what's happening.
Okay.
It's oxygen affecting the organic chemical compounds in the apple. Same thing with wine, so we want to protect the juice. I'm a firm believer in doing treatments to juice and not to wine. I think they integrate better. So making sure that the juice is in the right spec before we start fermentation is key to making great ice wine. So we'll treat the juice, get it in the right spot, and by that I mean we rack it a couple times, removing solids, getting it as clear as possible, and then starting fermentation. Fermentation generally for a table wine is anywhere between a week to 2 weeks. Ice wine's a little bit different, so it's up close to 3 weeks, almost 4 weeks sometimes.
Why do you need the extra time?
It's not that I need the extra time.
Well, why does it require?
It's the yeast, right? So you're dealing with a viscous liquid now. It's a lot more dense than typical juice.
So you got to go hardy.
Pressure, right? So it's pushing pressure on yeast, what we call osmotic pressure. The ability of a yeast to transmit stuff across its membrane is a challenge. So we have to make sure the yeast are happy and healthy. They don't get to move around as freely because it's more dense, it's more viscous. And yeast are suicidal maniacs. They're fermenting alcohol, which is toxic.
I've never heard them referred to that way,
right?
But
so
it makes sense.
They're doing something that they know is eventually going to kill them. So having a yeast culture built strong enough to get me to the finish, because nobody wants to drink a 6% 400 gram residual sugar wine. That's just not the end. We've got to get at least to 9% alcohol, right? So that takes a really strong culture to do that.
Right. I want to talk about the grapes, but I'm going to jump ahead to something. I want you to talk, and we're going to go backwards to the grapes. I want you to talk to me about vineyard and cellar practices. I know you're a hygiene freak.
Yes.
But how do you categorizes. You've also, you've used the words low intervention, mm-hmm. you know, which is not a buzzword, but it's the right thing. It's thoughtful right liming. What are you doing treatments in the field? Do you have to because where you are? I mean, are you tickling organics? You know, you're not using indigenous yeast because I don't think you can make ice wine. You know, so tell me about practices field to cellar.
Yep. So vineyard management, again, we have become a lot more sustainable in the way we do things. So it starts with scouting big time. So we have digital maps of all of our vineyards where we're scouting specific panels. We look for infestation diseases. In the past, if we noticed that there was leafhoppers or bugs during the growing season, we would spray that whole block, which may be 42 rows. We can now drill down to only 3 rows and 7 panels over here are affected. So we're only spraying 3 panels and those other 7
panels. So to that point, you're doing treatments, but instead of just blowing the whole property out, you're trying to be respectful to the rest of the property.
We're respectful to the land. We're not throwing anything in we don't need to. We use recycling sprayers now, too. So instead of those big sprayers that are blowing across half the field, we can spray 4 rows at a time. It's using a quarter of the actual pesticide that we actually need to use. So that's very respectful. It also comes down to cropping properly when it comes to ice wine and table wines, making sure that we're doing leaf removal, keeping those vines healthy, promoting airflow so that we're actually not needing to spray because we don't have disease pressure.
You mentioned moisture could be an issue, but the lake effect and the breezes help you, right?
Big time they help, and we have drainage between every other row too to bring the water away. So that's actually a tile drain that's put in between the row about 4.5 feet down to help move moisture away from the plants. So that's kind of what we're doing in the vineyard. In the actual cellar, we don't rest on our laurels. You said I'm a hydrating freak. That's number one. You look at any one of my tanks, they are spotless. The winery is getting a little bit older, but my tanks are very clean. The way we're improving is investing in new technologies. An example of this is what I call a ceramic disc filter that we have now. So when I started in Enniskillen, we would have large, vast amounts of lees, the solids, after we rack the juice, and we would have to leave them for weeks or months or treat them with chemicals or enzymes to get the clear liquid away from the solids. Right, which was not good for the juice. We're adding stuff to the wine that we don't want to have to add, but we have to because it's such a high value product. This machine, I challenged myself to find something that could process ice wine lees. So it literally takes solid lees that's maybe 30 to 50% solids, churns it down with no chemicals added. It doesn't matter the temperature of the juice, what's in the juice, and it turns it basically into peanut butter. So we don't have to wait as long, so we're being more sustainable because we're actually using 95% of the juice that we actually want to make ice wine now, which is huge. Being inventive, looking for new technologies, and using things that are better, right? So even things like enzyme rates. When I started, you used to have to use 200-300 mils per hectoliter of certain enzymes to break down pectins, which are, if you ever had apple juice with pulp versus non-pulp, the only way to break down pulp is to use a pectinase to break the pulp apart, right? So using enzymes that are now more efficient, better, more sustainable, vegan, all of these sorts of things we're taking into consideration.
But that, you don't have a choice with ice wine.
Sometimes, no, you don't have a choice, right? It's a hard liquid to work with.
I mean, it's a silly question, but can you make nothing added, nothing taken away, natural wine, wine? You can't do it, right?
There's no natural yeast in these conditions that will ferment that wine to where I want it to get. So we have a set of commercial strains that we use. But again, I'm very adamant about clean winemaking, and you said it yourself. So I'm avidly testing these wines for the amount of nitrogen, amino acids that are available, because all of those things yeast need to use to consume. It's their food to make alcohol, right? So if the wine has plenty of amino acids and nitrogen in them, I'm not adding those things. I'm leaving it in the current state that it is and letting it get its production done.
All right, Nick, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about the grapes, the varietals, you know, what goes into ice wine. And like I mentioned, you know, talk about some of the other wines. We're talking to Nick Gazuk. Nick is the winemaker at Enniskillen in Canada. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Nick Kazuk. Nick is the winemaker in Canada at Inniskillen. We've been talking about really what Inniskillen is well known for, and for good reason, and that's their ice wines. So we talked about the cellar, we talked about the vineyards, we talked about the process. I skipped, but I want to talk about the grapes. There's some specific grapes that go into making your ice wines.
Yep.
Because if you bop into France, they're not using the same grapes. So who cares about that for now? All right. So one of the prominent grapes that's important to Canada for ice wine is the Vidal grape. I think it's a little known grape to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going out on a stretch on that one. And then you use Riesling. Let's talk about the Vidal grape. Tell me a little about why it's so ideal. Tell me a little about some of the characteristics about it. And I didn't ask you this off air, but does anybody make non-ice wines with Vidal?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so.
But let's keep it in the ice wine context.
Sure. Yeah, so Vidal, again, it's a grape that's thick-skinned. It has natural high acidity, two characteristics that you really need for ice wine. Why thick skin's important? Again, we're leaving these vines out into Mother Nature's hands for they need a big coat, 2-3 months, right? So preventing disease and not having to spray them, not having to crop thin them, not having to do too much of them, makes Vidal one of the most consistent ice wine grapes. It's why 80% of the production in Canada is Vidal.
So the physical characteristic is the skin. What did you say the acidity is?
Yeah, it has naturally great high acidity in it. It also has these beautiful apricot nectarine-y flavors. Vidal is very distinct once it's fermented and got through the process. So it's a very aromatic ice wine.
All right. So, Nick, you and I have been tasting 4 wines before we sat down and while we're sitting down. So we tasted 2 off air and we're going to taste 2 on air. So while we're talking about Vidal, let's pick the Vidal up and let's talk about it quickly.
Yep.
So this specific wine is 100% Vidal?
100% Vidal. This is our 2019 gold. Why it's called Gold Vidal is I wanted to elevate the status of Vidal by adding a little bit of French wood aging. So second, third year old French wood added into this wine for about 2 months just to give it that mid-spice lift that we see in the wine. I also leave a little bit higher residual sugar in the back end to match that spice note. Because again, for me, ice wine's all about balance, beautiful acid, beautiful residual sugars, and all these lush, intense flavors that we get out of it.
So the other wines don't see wood?
Nope. So none of the other ice wines in my
what
category.
What is it? Is it stainless? Is
it's it all concrete? Stainless.
Okay.
Stainless fermented.
And what's the characteristic that you try to get and do get with the wood?
It's like a clovey spice note in the middle of the palate.
Right? Spice.
Yeah, it really.
Clove is really the note that you'll say first.
100%, right? So you get that nectarine, you get that peach that you get on the pearl, but then that clove note comes in the back end.
You get
that little bit of wood tannin roundness on the palate with the sugar in the back end on this one.
So it's a pretty beautiful gold. Do those teeny bubbles on the bottom mean anything? Is that coincidence?
Oh, that's just coincidence.
Yeah, I didn't know if that's, you know, acidity or whatever. What kind of alcohol?
So our Enniskillen Ice Wine is generally a 9 to 10 TA, which is similar to a French champagne. You got about 9 to 10% alcohol, generally right about 9.5. And then we have a residual sugar anywhere between 220 to about 260 on most of our ice wines.
It's gorgeous. All right, so we also know Germany's well known for their ice wine.
Yep.
Right?
Eisenwein.
Right. And Riesling is king in Germany. And they make their sweet wines with Riesling. You make a Vidal, and you also make a Riesling.
Yep.
Tell me the difference. You and I tasted it, and you explained it, but
yeah, so
they're two distinct wines.
Very distinct. Riesling is very elegant in its nature. The way it grows, the skins are a bit lighter. It takes a lot.
Lighter skins mean tougher vineyard.
Vineyard management, tougher control, harder to get to the finish line. Ideally, if I can harvest my Riesling ice wine in December, I'm a very happy guy. It's one of the first things I'll pick. I can leave Vidal out through a few frosts, but that first chance that I get frozen Riesling grapes, it's coming in. Why Riesling? I think it has all the right markers to make beautiful, intense, sweet wines. The spectrum of fruit on the Vidal is very tropical, nectarine, those sorts of flavors, where Riesling is very aromatic, tropical, thiol-driven wines that really approach well to a lot of foods. So it opens up the whole green aspect of fresh vegetables, fresh salads, spicy foods, Thai foods, Korean foods. It really lends itself as a food wine. Naturally high acidity as well, similar to the Vidal, but sometimes can get up north of 10 acid, which is great when you're talking about a sweet wine. It just has all the great markers to make a one-of-a-kind wine.
So if it had a thicker skin, it would be like the perfect thing. At least for you. What about growing season? You know, if you talk about Germany, different climate, different everything, Canada, where's the benefit? Is it in Canada, or do you think it's in Germany?
I mean, I think right now we got the edge over Germany.
Why?
I think we're more consistent right now. They've missed some ice wine vintages. They've been having a little bit of trouble getting to the actual cold temperatures in the areas that they plant ice wine. They've been dealing with some late moisture pressure on the hills and the slopes in Germany where they don't have airflow. These grapes potentially can rot on the vine before they can get them off for ice wine. So they've been dealing with some challenges in the last few years where we've been very consistent.
Are those a couple of bad years, or that's kind of
it remains to be seen, right? It really remains to be seen.
It could continue to be inconsistent.
Yeah.
So the word here for you is consistency.
100%.
We talked about it earlier.
Yeah, you know? We haven't missed, right? We're always there. I firmly believe that we're going to make an ice wine pretty much every year for the next 20 years. I don't see a reason why we're going to miss or have a problem getting. Again, we may not make all the varietals. I'm not saying we're going to make the whole collection, but we're going to make ice wine 1 year, right? There's been years where I've made Cab Franc and it's pressed off white. It's just not the year for Cab Franc. There's been years where we skipped Riesling just because we didn't really need it, or it just wasn't the perfect season for it. But again, we're going to make some form of Vidal pretty much every year, I'm pretty sure.
Right. I want to talk to you about Cab Franc, but I think I'm going to leave that towards the end of the show when we do our weekly wine sip. You and I will taste it, and that'll give us a chance,
sure,
you know, to delve into that. Let's not discount the fact that Canada is making wines other than ice wine.
100%.
I forgot to ask you this. When you're growing Vidal or Riesling for ice wine and you're letting it sit on the vines to freeze, your take when you harvest is what percentage, as if you were just growing, you know, the grapes to make.
So
it's crazy, right?
Yeah, it's pretty astounding, right? So you think about the volume that we would receive. Again, I'm going to have to do this in liters. Sorry about being Canadian, but
it's all right.
We're going to, the average table wine harvest, you're going to get 680 liters to maybe 750, 740 liters a ton of grapes. When it comes to ice wine, we're going to get 5 to 10% of that, which is 100 liters.
Jesus.
Okay, and that's if you're lucky. If you're getting the pressing, you're right at the right peak. The grapes are still healthy. They haven't dehydrated too much. Because the longer we wait in the season, too, the more freeze and thaws, the more they dehydrate. We're always losing volume. This is a very high-risk reward product, right? There's a reason why a lot of people don't do it.
So it's kind of earned and obvious that you're going to pay more, you know, for an ice. Think about it. It's like a tenth of the, you know, output. It's almost crazy. You know, what are you doing that for? All right, so let's talk about some of the other varietals. Yep. Let's stay within Inniskillen. That seem to grow well in Canada and grow well on the Inniskillen properties. Riesling, Pinot Grigio, you know, walk me through the predominant grapes and just tell me which are the more planted ones.
So we'll start with whites. Again, Riesling is very prominent in the area, does very well. There's lots of Pinot Grigio, Pinot Gris. Chardonnay is a huge hitter. Again, it's the most planted grape worldwide. There's no reason why it can't be in a
grows
cool,
well there?
It grows very well. Again, we do it in a cool climate style, similar to places like New Zealand and the west side of Australia, right, where it's very clean. We're not the big buttery Chardonnay California style. We also do things like Semillon. We do Viognier. I have Viognier actually on my property that I love growing every year. Sometimes it's a little hit or miss with Viognier, but it does well.
What do you use that for? Blending or do you bottle?
I make a table wine out of Viognier. Yeah,
that's fun.
Sometimes I throw the skins in with some of my Syrah as well. So a little bit of fun take there on a Syrah. Then we go to our reds. Again, we do Pinot, Merlot, Cap Franc, Syrah.
Pinot is a finicky grape, like Riesling, thin skin. I mean, does it do okay up there?
It does okay, right?
Climate so and everything?
We talked about the airflow, right? So Pinot's
Burgundian latitude.
Same latitude as Burgundy, right? So again, we have those cool nights where rot doesn't thrive when it's cool. It starts to slow down. If you're patient enough into the season where we could have some early disease pressure, you wait till it dries up and then you could pick a little bit later. It does very well. There's no reason why we don't make world-class Pinot, which we do. People just don't know it yet.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Then we do the big guys as well. We do Cab Franc is huge for us. It's a great varietal. It does very well. Versatile grape. We do Syrah and Cab Sauv too. In some of the best years, they're really,
so
really
what,
stunning.
What are the most planted varietals?
I would say Pinot, Chardonnay, Riesling, and Cab Franc are usually the top four.
Pinot, Chardonnay, Riesling.
Yeah, that's usually the top four. I'm not keeping Vidal in that category. It's probably up there as well.
Right.
There's a lot of Vidal.
We'll put that off to the side.
The noble varieties, those are usually the four that we're really talking about.
What's the most challenging to grow? Obviously, if you're keeping it, but it's challenging, what is like?
In my opinion, growing-wise, Pinot's hard. It's hard everywhere.
Right.
Tight cluster.
That's categorically hard.
I think Merlot is a challenge sometimes for us, too. It's not as winter-hardy as the rest of the reds, so it's very finicky sometimes. You really got to get it in the right spot. You have to get it in a warm site. If you've done your research.
So Merlot needs heat, right?
Yeah, Merlot needs heat.
Right. More than Cab Sauv.
More than Cab Sauv, more than Cab Franc, more than Syrah.
Got it.
It's not as winter-hardy as the rest. But it does make a beautiful, elegant wine, and I think that's often misconstrued. Thank you, Paul Giamatti, for that one. But
yeah, maybe it's made a comeback.
But I think it's really good. So
I remember reading when Donald and Carl started, they were planting Gamay.
Yep. So
is there any Gamay out there?
So in one of my series, I have a discovery series Gamay. Gamay's has a real resurgent right now. Again, there's a couple of varieties that are really making a comeback, Gamay being one of them. Bacco, the new hybrids are still, you're starting to see in the Finger Lakes, people using Cayuga White for pet gnats. You're starting to see Vidal table wines and all these different, and I think that's just a turn of the guard. Young winemakers revisiting all these varieties and trying to make a good product out of
it's
them,
a refreshing
cool.
It's very cool change that people are doing.
So
that
I don't think it's just resting on what we do well already. So I think we're, again, I brought back Gamay, I have Bacco back in my lineup, we have some Marquette now on our property too, which I might dabble into in the next few years, and maybe doing a Passamento style wine on that. Maybe I think it's got an opportunity to do really well. So
yeah, there's in Vermont and in the Finger Lakes, there's this resurgence of hybrids, mm-hmm. and you know, Nathan Kendall is using Catawba and you know, all these, you know, crazy.
And I think it's very cool for a lot of wine professionals and sommeliers and come from places like Italy where, you know, you're not allowed to use hybrids, right? So coming down and tasting these wines, it's a totally different world and learning for them, which is very cool too.
All right, so I want to ask you a few more questions. I want you to answer my wine list. And then we're not avoiding Cab Franc, which I know is a favorite of yours. We're going to spend time with that at the end of the show, tasting and talking. I'm asking you this question because I care and I have a little concern. Do you think Inniskillen and even other Canadian wineries have done a good job marketing ice wines and these wines? Let's start with the U.S. consumer and even abroad.
I mean,
is it where you want it to be? What can you do? I mean, stuff like this helps.
Stuff like this helps. I think originally ice wine was misconceived as only a sweet dessert wine. And I think that's still the way it is viewed today. And again, my mission is really to show people that it's a beautiful aperitif. It can pair very well with intense.
I'd hold that thought for a second.
Yep.
Because that was my next question, and and I talked about it. So part of it is education, which we're going to follow up on. What about, you know, sheer obvious stuff like marketing dollars or ambassadors? I mean, Laura Catena and her dad literally came from Argentina to the U.S. and made Malbec a thing.
You know? I think it could use a little bit more forethought. I think once we got out as far as we did with our export network, and I think Constellation not putting premium on the priority list and just resting on the laurels we had for a little while, I think wasn't the best for ice wine. Not only
did they not get it,
I'm not saying their
intentions weren't wrong, they just didn't get where to go at that time.
They didn't get the fact that in my mind, when I think Canada, I think hockey, ice, maple syrup, ice wine. They didn't understand that this could be an iconic Canadian product, right? And they didn't really push the envelope to make it so. Which I think with our new ownership, the way we're going about it now is really making people understand that ice wine is synonymous with Canada. It's really that same thing, right?
So this, the story's good.
It's a beautiful story.
The quality is, you know,
it's
great.
Exceptional.
It's not like, how do you push a crappy thing? It's like, you know, when you get it out there, it's really good. So there's still some work that needs to be done.
100%.
There were some missteps in the past, but the runway ahead looks pretty good.
It does look very good.
Okay.
Right? So there's, again, the U.S. is a big market for us, so we're going to be here a lot showcasing these wines.
All right, you were alluding to this, and I'll re-steer us back to it. You know, I said to you that ice wine could be like champagne, where people sort of think of it as a singular thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, crack the champagne, it's a birthday. You know, ice wine, oh, it's the sweet wine, you know, we'll have it for dessert or whatever. I think you were saying and continue that that's not just what ice wine is.
Not at all.
You know, so tell me why people should think about ice wine, you know, in all circumstances.
Food friendly. Again, you got beautiful acid. You have a wine that's very intense. For intense foods, you think duck, pâtés. You need a really rich wine to match with those things. Yes, it does very well with all these sorts of desserts, with honey, all of those things. It does very well with them. But again, main course-wise, you can pair it with very rich foods. You can use it in marinades, things like chicken, pork, all of those sorts of things. The acidity in that softens
the meat. Wait, use it in the marinade?
Use it in the marinade.
Okay, that's a right? cool thing. Because I know you should pair wines to the sauces as much as the meat.
Right? So using the ice wine actually in those sauces and cooking with it and then serving it with the meal.
Nick, you're a big baller. That's an expensive cooking wine.
Well, you know what I'm saying? But you're already going to open it, right? So, again, I'm not talking tons. You only need a little bit.
No, I know.
A couple teaspoons, right? So, again, cooking with it, using it, not only thinking about it, just pairing. But then you put it beside beautiful, strong cheeses, blue cheese.
So that's, smoked let's, Gouda. We're having friends over. You have a charcuterie platter. You have creamy cheeses. You have sharp cheeses. You have, you know, salamis, prosciutto, hard cheeses. A lot of people use blue cheese with those fig jams or whatever. This goes with all of that?
All of it. You put Vidal ice wine on a nice cracker with blue cheese and honey together, it's a match made in heaven. Why? Because the ice wine cleanses all that creaminess. The acidity cuts through those palates. It's a palate cleanser. So you go back to the ice wine, then you pick up your salami. You got those fresh flavors in your mouth, right?
So right. It's actually the cleansing oil, the fat
oil,
from the salami.
The fat. It really pulls all those flavors out. And it really changes those foods as you're eating them. And again, you think about wines that you're going to have with lunch. This is 9.5 alcohol wine. Right, you're having lunch with friends. You don't.
Well,
want to
I'm drinking
there.
This stuff for the last hour and a half. I have no buzz.
You don't have
which
to worry.
Is great.
About that.
Yeah,
you don't have to worry about that when you're going out for a lunch.
Yeah, well, that's a nice thing too.
And another cool thing is how often, being a wine guy, being a wine nerd, you go to friends' houses. You want to bring a wine. How often do you show up when there's a champagne, a Pinot, and a Chardonnay? That's always what's
different.
There. It's always what's there.
It's different.
Bring something different.
It's different.
I'm not saying bring my sweet wine, but bring a sweet wine.
I think you're giving champagne more credit. I don't think people show up with enough champagne.
No.
I think they show up with the Chard or, you know, some blend or something.
I know some champagne groupies, so maybe
but that's
my
different.
Opinion is
all right, so for a main course, you know, we don't have to go through the charcuterie plate, but if you, and I'm going to ask you this question in another form later, what's the perfect ice wine main course pairing?
So for me, again, I would love to see a nice roasted duck leg with my Cab Franc, with a Cab Franc glaze on the top of it,
okay.
With some fresh greens on the side of it. It just works so well together. Duck is such a dominant flavor that you need a wine that can really match up with
great.
That. Right? So it works really good together.
It sounds great. You know, the Cab Franc. All right. So let's jump into the wine list and then let's get to the Cab Franc, which I'm dying to taste and talk about. All right. So I have five questions. I've asked the same five questions to everybody.
Yep.
Don't dwell on these.
Okay.
We're running out of time. Be spontaneous. If you go too long, I'll cut you off. All right, so the first question is, what are you drinking now? Besides tasting, blending, and all that, what's in your fridge? What do you like besides this? When the seasons change, do you switch from this to this? What's on Nick's table in Nick's fridge?
I'm a sucker for rosé right now. I'm a part of that
okay,
trend.
Okay, so that is that a seasonal thing or a rosé all year round?
I like rosé all year round.
Okay, so give me a couple things you're liking.
Especially in the summer, right? So for me, I'm a big barbecue guy. I like smoking stuff. But I can't sit outside and drink a 14% Cab, 15% Syrah.
So rosé works for you?
Works with beef. So good.
I agree. I mean, people think rosé is like a summer pale pink. Know, I mean, we can get into a show on rosé.
But there's different rosés, too. You got to find a rosé that is, I don't want to say meaty, but bigger, bolder, purposely made rosé with lots of flavor, right? So not something that's either drained off or blended, but like a purposely picked rosé.
Give me a couple things now that you're liking or drinking.
I'm always a sucker for Loire Valley Cab Franc. Again, Cab Franc.
Cab Franc based.
Cab Franc based.
I'm with you there.
Cab Franc based blends.
Okay.
I'm always picking them
so
up.
So people remember that rosé could be made from you know, all kinds of, yeah, there's Italian rosé with Sangiovese, there's French. So what Nick's alluding to is he loves Cap Franc. The Loire is famous for Cap Franc. Their rosés are made from Cap Franc. Anything else you could think of?
Provence, yeah, they're doing some cool things there too, right?
I can't think of the winery. The woman that lived to over 100 made... Provence starts with a P, I think. I'll come back later. All right, so anything else besides the rosés?
Bone dry Riesling, too.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't sell very well in the market, but if you put a Riesling
German
for me,
or Germany, any representation?
German.
Do you have a maker or two you love?
No, not specifically. I go around. I like trying different things. I'm always trying to learn and educate my
palate. But it's funny you say that, because people go, "Ooh, I don't drink Riesling. It's so sweet." If you gave that guy the bone dry, he'd go, "This is pretty good."
Yeah.
Why are you saying it's not that popular?
Well, I think...
people want a little...
We've been trained to say we like dry wines, okay? And if you put a group of people in here...
yeah, that's baloney.
It's baloney.
Yeah.
As soon as you
people drink Bordeaux for the first time, they're like, what is this?
As soon as you put a little bit of sugar in there, they instantly love the wine.
What's one of the most popular wines in the U.S.? The Prisoner.
The Prisoner.
It's a blend with high residual sugar.
It's got like 15 RS in it.
It's playing to that palate.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to question two. We talked about this in many iterations. Let's talk about your favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you think is a great one, which we talked about. It's something I assume you don't eat every night, every week, every month, but, you know, it's what you know to be. Is it that duck and cab, or is there something else?
No, I'm a prime rib guy, so.
So classic prime rib in the juice?
Classic prime rib, bloody juice, and you got to give me a northern Brunello or Amarone, something like that. A big, big red wine with it.
Wait, you said Amarone. And you said Brunello?
Yep.
Montalcino?
Yep.
Okay. All right, so big wines.
Big wines.
All right. Yep. I like that. A lot of people go steak and cab. You go prime rib and Brunello. Good one. All right. This would be an interesting question because a lot of people I talk to travel, and a lot of them are in New York. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? So now let's talk about two things here. Is there any place up around you where you could walk in and the wine list is great, the vibe is cool, the people there are cool? Restaurant or wine bar or both? And is there anything in your travels that sticks out?
So down in Niagara, we were really lacking in a couple of cool wine bars. There's a couple little wine shops that have really opened up.
It's not happening yet? Because everywhere it's starting to happen.
Yeah, so we're, again, the ability to really do that and dive into it really hasn't totally opened up. There's a couple that are decent, but a couple of them, the ones I really love, closed because of COVID, which is hard to see, right? So you really got to go up to Toronto, which is about an hour away from me, to go to a couple of cool places. Big city, right?
Give me a place in Toronto that does it well.
It's called Cava Wine Bar on New York Street, I think. I'll have to look it up, the address.
But not just your average wine bar, kind of a cool place to walk into?
It's a cool place to walk into. It's kind of underground. The door's kind of off to the side.
Cool.
It's not really listed, so you got to kind of walk down a couple set of stairs, and it's got an underground 70s vibe to it.
Oh, so neat. That's exactly what...
suede chairs, right?
So you walk in, you go, this is a cool place. Am I wrong in saying or assuming that, to me, it seems like Montreal has a lot more places like that? Or
100%.
There's plenty. It is.
The vibe in Montreal is...
for wine, natural wine, cool wine. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure because I haven't been to Toronto as much.
I make a really cool blend at the winery that is the most popular wine in Quebec. It's called P3. So it's Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, and Petit Verdot. It's not a white wine. It's not a rosé, but it's like a white blend with a little bit of orange color. It's a wine that's
is it more of an orange wine? You had to pick, but
it's like in the middle, but I don't want to call it orange wine because it's not on the skins, right? But it's very cool and funky, so they love it, and they love wines like that.
Do you make it regularly?
Every year.
Just smaller volume?
It was a happy accident that was 200 cases. Now it's grown to almost 10,000 cases.
So I had a guy named Roger Chinchero on and Sutter Home. And they screwed up with that white Zinfandel. They left it on the skins. And what do? It became, a zillion cases.
Sometimes there's those accidents that happen behind winery doors.
All right, fourth question. Favorite all-time wine. When I originally structured this question and started the show, I wanted to know what was the rarest, most expensive wine you ever tasted. I don't care about that anymore because we all can tell us. What's the wine that had the most influence on you? What was that gateway? What changed the way you thought? Maybe it got you in the business. Could have been your grandfather's wine just because this is important to me. Do you have a wine or two that checks that box?
When I was in Australia, I got the opportunity to go to a wine tasting that I had no business being in the room. No business being in the room, but luckily in the door. At that tasting, there was a 1982 LaGrange poured. And that wine, that old, and at the time it was 36 years old, something like that, when I tasted it. Just the freshness, the purity of fruit, the amount of texture and layers that were built into that wine. You could just see the craftsmanship, the artistry, and the intention of that winemaker. So long down the track, he had that vision to see where that wine was going to be. Just a completely eye-opening experience for me, that I didn't view wine as a product anymore, as an art form and
a thing
encapsulated in time. Right?
That's how you answer the question. What's funny is I told you I've done this 250 times. Nobody's ever said that wine, and it could be arguably one of the great wines of the world.
Yeah.
You know, when you say, give me your top 10 NBA players, your top 10 baseball players, your top 10 hockey players, that may be in your top 10 wines, yeah. One of the, you know, the great wines in the lab. I'm surprised it doesn't come up. You know why? It's not in favor with everyone.
No, it's not. It's a real, again, that style of wine, that boldness, like it's, you got to be appreciative wine drinker to understand that wine.
That's a good answer, and I totally get it. All right, last question. You should be able to handle this, and if you want to stay within your barn, you could do that. You can go outside. So the question is, recommend to me best wine around $15, $20, $22. Recommend a red, recommend a white. You could do category, like Muscadet is a pretty good value for, you know. Okay. If you want to stay, if Inniskillen has those price points, give me some of those. If it's just favorites of yours, like Loire, Cab Franc, you can get for 20, you know, throw anything out at me. Okay. And the reason I ask this question is I have kids in their late 20s. They can't show up at a dinner or give a gift with $11, $12, $14 wines. They ain't paying $45, $50. Mm-hmm. So how do you wow, you know, at 20?
I think you have to stay, you have to go a little bit out of the box and try different regions, right? So
let's go.
Again, I was at a wine bar two nights ago, and I tried a Willamette Valley Pinot Noir that really blew my socks off when 15 years ago, and that wine on the wine list was, I don't know, $19 a glass, but I'm sure.
So that means
if you went up there and bought it, it's probably
the 18, retail 18, is somebody somewhere around
18, 19 bucks, right? Yeah. So again, regions.
So there's some Willamette Pinots
that's doing really good. You come up to Canada and look again, Pinots. There's great value for money in the Niagara region. There's some really good local producers are doing it. Myself, Taz is doing it. They make us.
How do you spell Taz?
T-A-W-S-E.
Taz.
Taz makes beautiful Pinot Noir.
So that checks the red box.
So whites.
It's usually easier for people to do the whites. Everybody struggles on the reds.
I'm a very picky white drinker.
So by the way, I'm going to interfere here, and a lot of people say you can get great Rieslings at lower price. You know, there's some value in Riesling. But I'm not giving you that as an answer.
But there is. So, and again.
So that's one.
That's one. And I think if you go out to BC and look at some of their whites, they're doing some really cool stuff on sandy soils, which impacts a lot of these whites because they're really stressed in these
things. British Columbia, way west. Is it same latitude, up or down?
It's up a little bit more latitude.
Okay. You think what kind of grapes?
Chenin Blancs. Oh, things I love like that. Which is really cool out there.
And they're selling for $20, $18.
$20, $18.
So British Columbia white Chenin Blanc.
Yep.
All right. Nobody's ever said that before.
I'm going to be the different guy.
All right. I didn't mention, but I'll post your answers on our social media in the coming weeks. All right. We got to wrap up the show. We got about 5 minutes to discuss this last topic. So every week we taste a different wine on air. We do a thing called the weekly wine sip. If I'm sitting here with a winemaker, why wouldn't I let him bring his wine on, taste it, and analyze it? So I saved the fourth wine for last, and it is – Cabernet Franc. Now, a couple things, and then I want you to do all the talking. Cabernet Franc is a favorite of yours, which is why we left it for last. Two things. Tell me specifically what we're drinking, and then tell me why you have this affinity for it. Then we'll taste and analyze.
So this is our 2019 Enniskillen Cab Franc Ice Wine. It's 100% Cab Franc. Again, picked, 19 was a great growing season for these wines. We had an early pick this year. We picked this about December 23rd. So about a month later, we had it ready to go and in bottle. This wine was fermenting. It was so very aromatic that I knew we had a real good winter here. The raspberry, strawberry, rhubarb, almost candied strawberry coming off this ferment really jumps out of the glass. It also has this real nice perceived, not herbal note, but this tanniny structure in the back end that some of the other ice wines don't actually get, being a red.
Right. Right? You right. talk tannin, you talk red. It really you talk on white wines,
that,
right.
It has that
ability. Gives you a structure to work with.
To give work with, right? So it pairs with some of these more herbal things. You can bring mushrooms and all those sorts of things into play with the Cab Franc. Is why it's versatile. That's what I like about it.
So let's do an analysis. When you look at the color, you know, we were talking about rosés before. It looks like one of these deep, dark provincial rosés, or darker. Yeah. You know, what would you say? It's like an orangish pink, translucent.
Yeah, I would almost say the middle of the heart of it. It's like a ruby red, and it fades out to a little bit of an orange.
Yeah, it bricks or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's the color. Let's throw it over the tongue and talk to me about mouthfeel. I have my opinions. I'll go first, and then I'll let the expert go, because the other wines were more cloying in a good way, because sometimes you use the word cloying as a negative. Oh, that's too cloying. You know, they're unctuous, they're thick, but it all works because the acidity is good. This is definitely, I guess by design or grape, a way less cloying wine, but it has that full mouth feel and that coverage, the glycerin-y. It's just a different profile.
Different profile, right?
And so it's nice. It's, you know, refreshing, not in the drink way, but refreshing to have a sweet wine that's not,
yeah, that
you know,
doesn't,
honey.
Doesn't dominate, covered with that honey character.
So
right?
Tell me about mouthfeel. What am so again, I right on that?
You're right on that. So again, when you taste ice wines, you're trying to really, any sweet wine, you're trying to get it to the back of your palate. You really want to pick up those fruit flavors first. You want the side of your palate really to draw that acid out and get the sweetness on the back end.
Is that the way palates work?
That's the way palates work, right?
Okay.
So you got to be careful on where you're putting what in your mouth too, right?
I knew something was going on, but you laid it out for me.
Right, so generally, we would use an aromatic glass or a diamond-shaped glass that would force you to lift that volume and get it to the back of your palate, bring the acidity in, and have the sweetness at the end. So you get this real round shaping of this wine. Cab Franc notoriously has that glycerin-y character to it, right? Being a red grape, it also has a little
bit
of...
You mean just straight up Cab Franc?
Just straight up Cab Franc. It always has that character that comes out into it. Again, with ice wines too, we're going to have a little bit of a buildup of acetic acid, which really lifts the fruit too. So they have a little bit higher VA levels because it's challenging for the yeast to ferment, which really brings that fruit out, rounds the palate out. And again, it's not cloying, like you said, because the acidity really cuts it. So it's almost cleansing to your palate that it's there, it's long, but it's sweet, and then it rounds off, and it just slowly dissipates.
All right, so stick your schnoz in the glass and tell me, give me the characteristics on the nose. I suck at this, but when you go raspberries or whatever, I go, oh, yeah. So what do you got?
So for me, this is a real rhubarb dominant, like a candied rhubarb.
This vintage, or are you going to pick up rhubarb on
You'll generally get rhubarb on most of them.
Okay.
This is more of a...
So rhubarb is a sweet, sour, tangy, or what are you...
Yeah, tangy character to it. And then the strawberries, yeah, I would say it's a little bit fresh strawberry. There's a real dried raspberry note in there. And people, well, how do you know that? I said, well, you have to be conscious when you're eating those things, right? The last time you had a strawberry, when did you actually think about eating the strawberry and the taste in your brain? It's muscle. You have to use it to get used to it, right?
Totally agree. But when's the last time you had a dry raspberry?
Well, they're sitting in my fridge right now. So.
Well, that's because you don't know what the hell you're doing. All right. Let's go to palate.
Yep.
Does the palate replicate the nose, or do you pick up other things, additional things too? We did mouth, feel, color, nose. What are we tasting straight up?
Yeah, you really get that. You get the rhubarb, you get the strawberry. There's also this dried black plum note that comes in the back end. The plum's really dominating that character. And that's the cool thing, too, because ice wines are evolving, right? This is a three-year-old wine now. Ice wines age beautifully 10, 20 years down the track. And that fruit will slowly have an ebb and flow where it changes from dried characters to fresh fruit and then back to dried characters.
So I think it's important people know this. You buy ice wine, you buy a quality ice wine like Inniskillen, you could lay it down 5, 10, 15, 20
easy.
Years. And like you said, it goes through this evolution.
And if you're a drinker that likes an aperitif, you like sipping on a wine, when you open a bottle of our ice wine too, it will stay in your fridge for 8 to 10 days after you open it and be just
there
as good
go.
As the day you opened it.
It's two weekends.
Two barbecues.
Two Saturday barbecues.
Right? So that's a real advantageous sell point.
Give me, on this specific particular wine, give me the best food pairings.
So Cab Franc, again, I love having it with a really intense cheese with some salami on a charcuterie board. You have to throw like a Parmigiano Reggiano, a smoked Gouda, a blue cheese. You have some really good salamis or soppressata beside it. It's
so
just
great with the strong
charcuteries. Strong
cheeses, yeah. Like a hard Parmesan,
yeah.
Or a smoky, like you said, Gouda.
And then on a main course dinner, again, you get some duck confit with like some eggplant and all sorts of different garden variety vegetables, even beets. Those red flavors really come together and really round out the whole meal.
All right, so start thinking about ice wines for your meals, all right? All right, Nick, we got to wrap up. Let me do a quick wrap-up, and let me get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your pods. If you subscribe, podcast shows up automatically. You wake up next to Nick. There's the podcast. When's the last time you woke up next to some Canadian guy making wine, right? Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. A little confusing, but you can always reach us on both with the hashtag TheGrapeNation. We're on Facebook at TheGrapeNation. As I mentioned, we'll post Nick's wine list. I'll give you those answers. He had some interesting answers. And I will give you the wines that we tasted on air and off air for our weekly wine sip. Nick, correct me if I'm wrong. We tasted two Vidals, a Riesling, and a Cab Franc, right?
Correct.
So I'll put those on our social media sites. Nick, a couple things. If our interest is piqued and we want to find more about Inniskillen, where are the best places to go?
Inniskillen.com.
Inniskillen. Inniskillen. Now let's talk about social media. Inniskillen social media, Nick's social media. Is Inniskillen on?
Yep. So at Inniskillen Wines is our handle on Twitter and Facebook and all these social medias. My personal Instagram is Nick Into Wine.
NickIntoWine.
Correct.
All right, Nick, we got to get you more followers.
Okay.
Maybe this will do. All right. Thank you to our guests, Nick Gazuk. Got that right, right?
You got it right.
Finally. Thanks to our engineers, Liam and Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.